what an introduction. Thank you. Hi, everyone. My name is Carolyn. I am an alcoholic. And regardless of whatever meeting I'm sharing at, it's always a little nerve-wracking. I'm always fine right until before. And I got to remind myself, it's not about me. It's about my higher power, whatever message he wants me to give tonight. And be okay. I always want to be the most profound speaker everyone's ever heard. I want to be the funny one. And yet, you know, there's part of me that also wonders, do I have really anything much good to say or to share, you know? Someone was sharing last night, the battle of egos, you know, and I go through that on a daily basis. I've always wanted to be above and better than everyone else, and I also thought that I was beneath and not good enough, all in the same token, you know? Anyhow, I'm supposed to share my experience, strength, and hope with you, and I hope I do a good job of it tonight. If I'm not speaking loud enough, please let me know. I have a blocked ear, so I'm trying not to yell. But if you want me to speak up,
you
just let me know.
Mm-hmm.
I could yell? Okay, so...
What did you say?
Oh. I'm just going to take a moment. It's a privilege to talk, to share in AA. And I've been in coming to the meetings since 1999. And my first kick at the can, I got 6 years of clean and sober time. And I went back out to, I guess, to make my story even longer, even more miserable. And today, I'm humbled by the fact that I have a place to come to, that I can relate with people. I don't have to be alone. And this is a privilege. It's a miracle. It's a miracle. It's free. And there's people here who have my disease who are willing to help me, and all I have to do is be willing to learn and willing to help other people and pass it on. And to me, it's a tremendous gift. And I want to protect that gift. I guess I took the rooms for granted before, and today I don't. So I'll tell you a little bit about me, about growing up, and what it was like, how I got here, and of course what it's like today. I'm one of three. I grew up in Montreal, and my parents split. I was 14 months old. My younger brother was 2 weeks old. And I was kind of shipped from home to home for about 2 years. And like families, you know, members of my family's homes. And my mother was ill, so my father got full custody. So when I grew up, you know, as a child, I already felt different. I believe today, regardless of whether I have lots of alcoholics in my life or I had the best upbringing in the world, I really believe that my disease is in here. There's no one to blame. It's who I am. It's what I have. And, you know, I could have had thousands of people loving me, telling me how wonderful I was, how smart I was, and I would have never believed it. That's just what my disease tells me. My disease wants to kill me spiritually, physically, mentally, and emotionally. So I need to do everything I can do on a daily basis to arrest it. And I only have today, I only have this moment. So I grew up, you know, I did well in school. I was actually above average. I remember in high school, I in the 10th grade, they had said, you know, when I got into grade 7, the big deal was the 10th grade, because apparently the 10th grade was the hardest one to pass. So in my mind, you know, I was 10th grade, I was going to kick ass in, and I did. You know, I actually, passed with honors. And as I was going, you know, picking up my certificate of honors, I remember thinking the teachers graded me easier than they would the other students. And that's just to show you how low my self-esteem was. I could never take credit for the good stuff. I never felt good enough. I always felt different. I felt like a phony, you know? I was very uncomfortable. I remember in school, if they would have given grades on looking out the window, I would have definitely passed with an A plus. My mind was never in the moment. It was always spinning. I was always daydreaming, fantasizing. I fantasized all the time. I fantasized about having a good family and good parents that didn't fight all the time, not having the cops come to my house, not watching, you know, the violence that I've seen. I fantasized about that all the time. And I guess as a child, my first escape was books. I love to read books. And I guess the personality that I am, I go big or go home, and I could have 7 or 8 different books at a time. I'd be reading them all, you know. And that was my escape from my home. By the time I was 11, and my parents, you know, had a poor excuse for, I always like to say this, a poor excuse for a bar. They had, you know, the 40-ounce gin, rum, and vodka. And that was it. And I think that lasted for years, the same bottle. And they were for our visitors, you know. My parents are not drinkers. Anyways, when I was 11 years old, I drank on a resentment. I had overheard my parents arguing yet again, and this time it was about me. And I decided that I was going to fix that by drinking. I mean, I don't know. Actually, I do know. I'm an alcoholic, so that's what I did, you know, even though I'd never seen it. Or to me, even when I came in here, I was 24 years old. My idea of an alcoholic was, first of all, it had to be a man. Don't ask me why, but my concept of an alcoholic had to be a man, and it was, you know, the gentleman at the park bench with the big trench coat and the paper bag. That, you know, that was my idea of an alcoholic. So I got drunk. I blacked out. I was 11 years old. I blacked out. I remember a couple of my friends had come over, and apparently I was really funny, and I couldn't believe it because that was something I always wanted to be, was really funny. I just remember feeling like the world had lifted, and I felt free, and I felt good, and I could just, like, I'd arrived, you know? I just felt that comfortable feeling I'd been looking for all my 11-year-old life. So I guess I kept that in my back pocket, and, you know, just status quo. I danced ballet for many years. I danced for a company. I started as a little girl. I was 5 when I started ballet, and that was my biggest passion. And I was, you know, privileged enough to dance at the Sadie Bronsman Center and try out for the Grand National Ballet. And I danced for Ballet West for many, many years. I did the Nutcracker and Coppelia, and I loved it. And even though I was a good dancer, in my mind, I was horrible. I wasn't even good enough then, you know? Anyhow, went to school and had ballet, had lots of friends. And I remember coming home, you know, my parents used to get really upset because we didn't have call waiting back then. And the phone was always ringing off the hook, and it was always for me. And it's funny, if I talk to my friends, I have many friends who I've known for about 20 years now. You know, they've been in my life for a long time. And my perception, I have a disease of perception, you know, and my perception was that I wasn't good enough, and I was ugly, and I didn't have any boyfriends, and I was a geek, and you know, if you talk to my friends, they're like, are you kidding, Carolyn? We hated you. You had boyfriends running after you. You were the popular girl in school, and you were on the student council, and, you know, and it's just crazy how I think, you know. I have to remember that I can't trust my mind, and I need to come to AA to remind myself of that, because I have a disease that wants to tell me I don't have one. And if I don't keep coming to the meetings and remind myself, you know, I'll make the same mistake that I did before, and let's go back out. And if anyone's thinking about going back out, let me tell you, let me be the first one to tell you it's not worth it. I'll get back to that in a little bit. Anyway, so I remember in high school, 11th grade, when we all passed, I remember feeling this huge rush of panic. All my friends seemed to know what they were doing. You know, this one was, you know, applied at that school, and this one was going to do this with the rest of her life. And I felt that somehow, you know, everyone knew about this exam and had studied for it except for me. I felt lost. And the irony to this was, when I was little, I couldn't wait to be 18 years old so I could do what I want and I could have power and, you know, I could run away from my house and I wouldn't have to live the misery I was living. And finally I turned 18 and I was lost. And my parents basically gave me they gave me a choice. They said, you can go to school full time and get a part-time job, or you have to get a full-time job. So I got a full-time job. I was the first one of my friends that was making decent money. I was working as an assistant photographer. I loved it. And soon enough, I got a promotion, and I was running the lab there, and, I was being creative. I loved it, and I'm making good money. So basically, I worked, 5-6 days a week, and I partied 7 nights a week. And my friends, were graduating from Sejip by now. Some of them had met their boyfriends, and they were settling down, getting married, and going on to university. And I had conned myself into believing that I didn't want any of these things, that I never wanted to get married, I never wanted to have kids, I wanted to be a gypsy, I wanted to be free and travel, And the bottom line is, if truth be told, it was because I didn't feel that I deserved any of these good things. I didn't think I was good enough to be a mom. I didn't think I was good enough to settle down and get married. I didn't think I deserved the normal things that other people do. So as my friends were growing up and growing on and being responsible, of course I started changing friends because, we didn't have much in common anymore. I needed friends that liked to party, friends that were more like me, and the only thing that I had in common with these people was the fact that we partied. We partied, and I would drink to blackout, but I could go months and months without drinking as well. I know today it's not the amount of alcohol I drink, it's about how it affects my life. And the bottom line for me is when I pick up that first drink, I cannot guarantee my behavior. I cannot guarantee where I'll be, who I'll end up with, what I'll do. And it doesn't matter. It doesn't matter if I can go 3 or 4 months without one. I know that today, and I'm not willing to throw away my life and the people in it for that first drink anymore. And you guys taught me when I came into AA, all I have to do is give up one drink. And I used to try and figure out what number is that one? Is it the 7th one, the 10th one, the 11th? Because I was always trying to find the magic formula, because I knew, when I got past that certain amount, that was it. I'd black out, And the bottom line is, it's really simple. It's just that first drink. It's the only one I have to give up, that first drink, and everything will be okay. So by the age of 24, my friends had started to, or my really good friends had started to disperse. They really didn't want to have much to do with me, only because they didn't want to see me self-destruct anymore. And I remember I walked in, I was living with my best girlfriend at the time, and I walked into her apartment, and there was about 4 or 5 of my close friends, friends that I'd known since I was about 10 years old, talking about me and saying, we have to stop her, and she's not the same girl she used to be, and we're worried about her. And I was furious. I thought, how dare they talk about me? How dare they not consult me? As far as I was concerned, this was my life, my choices, and it had nothing to do with you guys. And the truth of the matter is, my disease has a rippling effect, and the decisions I make have a rippling effect. So when I'm picking up that first drink, I may as well forget my morals, my values, my principles, my friends, my family, my job, everything. I didn't think about that. Everything was all about me. I had had a very, very troubled childhood, and the way I looked at it was, now it was my time to have fun. It was going to be all about me now. And anyhow, I'm grateful today because it's brought me to where I am. So I'm 24 years old, and I'm on my 10th job in 12 months, and the only reason why I know this is because in the first year of recovery, you guys told me I had to do things like income taxes, and I did them on time that first year, and I had 10 jobs in 12 months, and so I'm on my 10th job, and I'm working in a bakery overnight, and again, it was a friend of mine who had got me a job. We alcoholics have lots of enablers, people who want to help us. And they do it through love, but, sometimes we can love someone to death. So anyhow, I got this this job, and it was perfect for me. I do have a little bit of drugs in my story. I'll keep it to alcohol. However, my this job was perfect for me because I was the boss, and I had two young guys working with me on overnights, and their job was to roll the joints as fast as they could, and my job was to get rid of the clients as fast as I could, and I can get stoned all night, you know. And basically, I lived like a cockroach. I hated myself so much that, you know, when I got up at 5 or 6 o'clock at night to get ready for work, I would put on my makeup, and I could not look at the mirror after that. And I would, you know, work and then come home and sleep all day. I just could not face myself. That's how much hate, self-hate I had. And it's not a good way of living. I think, I'm sure some of you guys can relate. And if I wasn't working, I was partying. You know, I'd party all night and sleep all day, and I really lived like a cockroach. That's what I, you know. So I had this gentleman come in one day. I had also, growing up, my parents believed in family therapy for dysfunction. And I hated family therapy. Actually, I hated the family therapist because I felt like I was going to the principal's office once a week. You know, she did this, she did this, she did this. And but really, this woman helped me. This lady Barbara had really helped me. And at this point, I had nobody to talk to. And even if I did, I could be in a room full of people who tell me they love me. And if I allow myself, I'll get into a headspace where I think I'm alone. And I believe I'm alone. And nobody cares about me, you know? But I was alone, and I was repelling a lot of people, my behavior. And I was... I lost a lot of jobs. I get hammered, hungover, call in the morning, I'm sick, and then be upset because, you know, my boss would fire me, and I'd be like, but I'm really sick. And I was so sick that I didn't even think about, hey, I was the one who got myself in this mess to begin with, you know. I justify, well, I am throwing up. Well, if I hadn't drank, you know, half a bottle of tequila, maybe I wouldn't be, you know, sick this morning. Anyway, so I repelled a lot of people. I had nobody really to talk to in my life. All I knew is that I was dying inside. I hated myself. I hated my life. And I was miserable. And this gentleman came into my bakery. And like I said, pot is... I was a big pot smoker. You know, that was another resentment I had. Because I was born in 75. And I really wished I was, like... growing up in the 60s, because I thought that I should have been a love child, and because I love peace and love and to chill out, and I thought I was cool and a tree hugger, you know, save the environment. And anyways, he came in, he told me about the spiritual program that he knew about that was going to teach me how to live life. And I thought, hey, I love Janis Joplin, I love joints, I love the outdoors, I'm totally spiritual, I'm up for this program, you know. So he tricked me into my first AA meeting. And my first meeting was Serendipity Thursday nights. It's still my home group today. I was there at 7 o'clock and super scared. I was only 24 years old. Super, super scared. And what I remember is the light in your eyes and the laughter in the room. And I remember thinking to myself, oh, I want some of that. But I thought you guys were full of crap, eh? There was no way you guys were sober. No way. But I knew I was going to learn how to drink in AA, you know? So I came around for 9 months. I go to meetings, and basically my meetings revolved around all the cute guys. So I knew where all the cute guys were, and I go to those meetings, and it doesn't matter. You know, I really believe it doesn't matter. Whatever takes you to a meeting, you know what? If you don't get AA, it will soon enough get you. And that's all. So... I go to, thank God, there was a lot of cute guys that helped me stay sober and kept me coming to meetings, you know. But it wasn't working. It really wasn't working because basically I'd be the last one in the room and the first one out of the room. And when you girls would come up to me and ask me, you know, my name or are you here, you know, because you're alcoholic, I'd say, no. I'm just here to check you guys out. Just here checking it out, that's all. I was positive that I would learn how to drink in AA like a lady. So finally, you know, I'm a West Islander. I grew up with, you know, like pretty much, I didn't need for anything. And I ended up homeless. I had nothing. 24 years old, no more job. My friends had enough of me. And I had to find a place to live. I just started AA, and I'll never, ever forget that feeling of no more keys on my keychain. That was really hard. So this gentleman who had 30 years, who had 12-stepped me, you know, told me that maybe I need to make a phone call to Beaver. It was he told me it was a spa. And he told me that, you know, they only woke up at 10 o'clock in the afternoon, which was, like, pretty early for me still. But 10 o'clock was much better than normal people waking up at 7 for a job, you know. So 10 o'clock, I thought, okay, free meals. I don't have to pay rent for at least 5 weeks. I can find a place to live while I'm in there, and it's a spa. Like, who doesn't like a spa? Because, God, I need a break. I've been partying for so long. It's hard work partying, you know? So they got me in right away, and really blessed. And, of course, it took me a few weeks to thaw out in there. But I remember someone making me laugh. About my third week there, someone made me laugh. And I mean laugh. Laugh where it came from down here. And it had been years since I had laughed like that. And I'm a greedy person naturally. And I said to myself, I want more of this. I want more of this. So when I got out, I took all of your suggestions. You guys told me to find a sponsor. Well, I had a sponsor the first 9 months. I was looking out for the cute guys. Because if you guys asked me if I had a sponsor, at least I could tell you I had one. But I never picked up the phone, you know. And I had a big book, and you guys told me the real work was the first 163 pages in the big book. Well, there was no effing way I was reading those. I read the little stories in the back, because I don't like to work, and I like the easier, softer way, you know? Never read the big book, did not like 12 and 12 meetings, did not like big book studies, did not like discussion meetings. I loved speaker meetings, that way I could stay incognito and get out. Well, I got a sponsor. Started using her little bit by little bit. Little bit. Didn't trust very many people in the family. I got active. I think I did coffee at Serendipity for about a year. I was the special girl. They made me the special coffee girl, you know, and I felt important. I was so shy, so painfully shy. I remember saying, like, how am I going to do all of this? And they say, well, Carolyn, don't you like to invite people into your home? And I'd be like, of course. I'm a party girl, of course. And they say, well, treat your home group like your home, like you're inviting people into your home. And somehow that fit for me. So I'd bring cookies and little extras, and I'd make everything had to be perfect, the napkins and the cookies and the coffee and the tea. But I felt a part of. That's when I started feeling good about myself, you know, a little bit. They say we have an insidious disease, but recovery is insidious as well. It really is. It sneaks up on you in spite of yourself, in spite of myself, and I'm really grateful for that. You guys talked about a higher power as well, and I had issues with that. First of all, I'm also a recovered Catholic, so I'm like, no way, Jose. I remember, you know, you guys would talk about God, and the hairs in the back of my neck would just, I had such an issue with God, because as far as I was concerned, you know, if God really existed, God wouldn't have put me through everything I had gone through. I wouldn't have seen all the horrible things I had seen. And somehow, he forgot about me. And I think that I was always a just-in-case person, you know? Whenever I go party, I'd always put $20 in my shoe, in the bottom of my shoe. That way, when I had no more money left, at least I could cab it home. So that was my just-in-case. Towards the end, I'd always end up spending the 20 bucks anyways. But I was also a just-in-case prayer. Every night as a child, I would pray, and I'd buzz right through the Our Father, just in case I might merit like an iota of chance of getting into heaven. But I was petrified of God because, like I said, you know, I was Catholic, and, you know, my concept of God was very, very scary. And I always thought God would come and grab me or something. So I'd pray really quickly. But when I was 15 years old, you know, my cousin Jeremy, who I was very, very close with, who I loved very, very much, had passed away suddenly. And that was when I had decided I hated God. And I just shut the door, and there was no more just-in-case praying for me. So at 25 years old, you guys are talking about spirituality, and I'm thinking, screw you. You know, don't. I thought this is a cult. You guys are going to brainwash me. You're all crazy. You're all drinking, I'm sure. You know, but you guys also told me about good orderly direction. And the first step made sense to me. You know, we admitted we were powerless over alcohol and that our lives had become unmanageable. I had a hard time with the first part of the step, but the unmanageability I really, really related to. And I didn't want to live that chaos anymore. You guys also taught me about good orderly direction. So I thought, wow, I don't like the unmanageability in my life. I definitely do need good orderly direction. So I was able to digest that a little bit, you know. You guys also told me about group of drunks. So I had made my home group my higher power. Slowly but surely, you know, everything evolved. So anyways, at this point I'm about 2 months sober. I'm 25 years old and I'm bitter because I'm in church basements with old fogies that I know that they're drinking, but they're, you know, they're not telling me the truth. And I'm dying to learn how to drink properly. And I was only in this game for 9 months. I wanted 9 months of clean and sober time. Not a year, not 8 months, but 9 months for whatever reason was in my mind. Anyways, one afternoon I met Nooners in Dorval, that helped me get sober, you know, going to meetings every day. I also did 90 and 90. You know, you guys told me to do 90 and 90. I was always willing to go to the Depeneur, the bar, rain, shine, 40 below. And you guys told me if I can do that, then I can make an hour aside, take an hour aside a day and go to a meeting. So I did. And remember Big Jim had said to me, you know, Carolyn, you're going to St. Jerome Young People's Conference. I thought, first of all, you know, defiant that I am, I'm thinking, who the hell is he telling me what to do and where I'm going, you know? I was just so angry and resentful that he told me, young people. And I thought, well, I really need young people. I'm 25, poor me, I'm in church basements all the time, and I hate it. So he hooked me, and I went up, and I was so petrified of everybody. I mean, I was having a really hard time with people. I was so petrified of people. So I basically hid in the kitchen the whole time and in the smoking room and helped, you know. I cut up lots of fruits and vegetables that weekend, that's for sure. And I ended up meeting a young guy. His name was Mike. And he kept staring at me, and he was 18 at the time. And I'm angry, but really fearful, because that's what I am, a fear-based person. And I'm chopping up these fruits and vegetables, and I've got 2 months of sobriety, and I'm absolutely miserable. And he asks me how much time I have, and I'm like, oh, 2 months. And he just looked at me, and he said, wow, you're amazing. I only have 1 day. And something happened to me right then and there. And I was like, wow. I got to know Mike, you know. And they say women with women and men with men. And for some reason, my gut told me this was different. And Mike and I shared a beautiful 5-week relationship, friendship, clean, healthy, and wholesome friendship. And I started to share with Mike. I started to open up to him. I started telling him about my fears, my dreams, my opinions, things I hadn't shared with anyone all of my life. Not with my best friends, not with anybody. But somehow, some way, I knew, for his sake, that I needed to open up. He had asked me to be his temporary sponsor, and I freaked out because I knew about that men with men and women with women, so I called my sponsor, and I said, I don't know what to do. And she said, well, tell him you'll do meetings with him, and you're going to look for a male sponsor. So that's what I did. I said, I'll be your temporary sponsor, but, you know, I said, you have to call me every day. You have to read the big book. And what was it? You have to go to meetings every day. Well, wouldn't you know, I went to meetings every day. I read the big book in 3 days because I'm thinking he's going to ask me questions and I don't know the answers. But 3 days that big book was read. And I also told him he had to be honest. He had to pick up his beginner's chip. I started becoming honest with my sponsor. So, my big fear is getting close to you, right? Because if I get close to you, you might find out what I'm really all about, and you might think that I'm not good enough. because that's how I feel inside. My fear is that if I get close to you and start loving you, you might leave. You might die. You might abandon me, because that's what happened to me all my life. So Mike went out on a 4-hour slip after about 4 weeks. And he called me that night. And I told him to come back. I begged him to come back, and that I'd make him a cup of coffee, that it wasn't too late. And he ended up having a severe accident. And he fell off an 8-meter wall. And I was the only phone number that they had. And when I showed up at the hospital and I saw all those tubes and his face mangled and his whole body mangled, those 5 minutes, an hour, did not apply to me. I slept next to Mike every day. Every night. And I prayed like I hadn't prayed. And after 2 weeks, they decided to take him off life support. And it was the hardest thing I had ever gone through. But it was also the biggest gift that I have received in recovery, other than my daughter. Because you know what? My biggest fear... Thank you. My biggest fear had come true, you know? And I was angry with God. You took him away. But ironically enough, it gave me the gift of faith. Because three days after Mike passed, I had this dream. And if I never believed in heaven then, I have no doubt in my mind that there is a heaven today, and that there is a higher power, and that it's beautiful, and that it loves me just as I am today, with every flaw. It loves you too. Just the way you are today, with every flaw. So I used Mike's death. I figured he might die, but his message can go on with me. So I stayed out of relationships, you know, for 3 years. I had wanted to do the 1 year. But every year, you know, I decided I wasn't ready. So I went 3 years, no relationship. And I told Mike's story. And I did a lot of service. I worked with a lot of young girls. I worked my steps three times. I did 2 17-week workshops, and I also worked my steps with my sponsor. And things really started coming together for me. You know, life was pretty good. I had balance. I had a life outside the rooms. You know, the first year or two in AA, I had to make my life about AA, and I had no business in going to bars and doing a lot of the things that my girlfriends were doing, you know? Like, I was at an age where a lot of my girlfriends were getting married, and there was bachelorettes. And after a couple of years, I found my own recipe. My sponsor told me that I would find my own recipe, and you will find yours too if you're new. You will find your own recipe. AA has a lot of suggestions. They're only suggestions. But you've got to remember, they're suggestions for a reason. It's because they work. And there's people who've been in the rooms much longer, for many, many more years before you. And it's wisdom, you know. There's a lot of wisdom in these rooms. So I found my own recipe. I would do 3 to 4 meetings a week. That, for me, was healthy. I got a life outside the rooms. I started dancing again. I danced Chicago with another company. I was playing softball, which for me was huge, because my biggest fear is being with people. And I had never been, I did swimming and ballet growing up. I was never part of a team. And for me to be part of a team was very scary. So I went out there and I did it. And I had fun. You know, I started off with a really good company 6 months after, working for a very good company 6 months after I got sober. And I'm still with that company today. And I started off in the warehouse, working midnights and dirty and whatever. And today, you know, I'm a buyer analyst. and I spend millions of dollars, and I get to save millions of dollars, and I love spending other people's money. It's fun. Who loves, you know, what a job. I get paid to spend other people's money. It's great. And I love, I'm excited with my job, you know. Anyways, I ended up with about 6 years. My fifth year of recovery, I had a baby girl, Brianna. And best gift of my life, other than the gift of faith and sobriety. And I stopped doing meetings so much. You know, I used Brianna as a cop-out. I was tired. I was a single mother. You know, Brianna's father was an excellent man. We just didn't jive. And for me, I think the best role model I can be for Brianna is to be happy. I wanted to be a happy mother, and I didn't want to settle down. Her father and I are very good friends today. I know we're a very strong unit for her, even though we live separately. And that's program, because him and I hurt each other a lot, you know, right around the time she was born. And you guys taught me to forgive, that forgiveness is a gift that I give to myself. And I did. And because I was able to forgive, and he was able to forgive, we have a wonderful relationship today, and it's Brianna that benefits, you know? And I hated this man at one point. And you guys told me to pray for him, and oh, fuck. Who wants to pray for someone that you hate? You know, and hate's a strong word, but man, did I hate him. And this is how I pray. If you guys are all wondering, like, how do you pray for someone you really dislike? This is exactly how I say, God, you know I don't mean this, but could you, you know, and I pray for whatever I want. And then it would actually turn out, you know, after a few months, it was, God, this is a really good man. Please show him the way. Give him all the love and the laughter and the hope and the health that I want for my, you know. It's amazing how this program really changes you. Anyhow, needless to say, I had a baby, and I stopped doing meetings and forgot who I was. And that stinking thinking came back. And the bottom line is that I have an allergy. I have a physical allergy followed by a mental obsession for alcohol. When I pick up that first drink, I'm going to like it. I'm going to like it. I'm going to forget all the hangovers, all the degrading things I did, all the degrading things I said, all the horrible actions I did towards myself and others. I forget that. It's in the big book. A physical allergy followed by a mental obsession. And when I pick this up, this poison up, that's it. I might die. I might kill someone else. I might end up in an institution. And those might be the best things. Never mind what else can happen. So I stopped doing meetings, and before I knew it, I was at a party, and I had one drink, no big deal. I hadn't been going to meetings for about a year. One drink was great. Then for about a year, I was fine. You know, I have suppliers. They like to take me out, you know, for dinners. I spend lots of money. They want to wine and dine me. Of course, I was always in control, you know, just a couple of glasses. I would even, you know, because I could never understand those people who could have a glass of wine or a beer and not finish it. Drove me nuts, you know, like, what a waste. So I would purposely do it, you know, that year. I would look at me. I don't need it. For a year, I'm like, look how good I am. I am so in control. Then my mother died last year in October suddenly. Well, that just gave me the green light. Well. We're Irish. What do you do when someone dies? You party. So I got hammered, you know? And then, of course, the next few times I got hammered, I said, well, I meant to get drunk. I'm allowed to get drunk. My mother's passed. Anyways, last April, I realized, you know, I need to come back to the rooms. I felt good when I was in the rooms. I felt good when I had program. I need to do what feels good. Drinking does not make me feel good. It makes me feel good for about 10 minutes. That's it. But all I do when I pick up that first drink is magnify all of my problems. And my head is crazy. That's the bottom line. It's crazy. And this makes it much crazier. So I started coming back to the rooms, and I was honest. You know, I told people I was still drinking and that I was struggling with whether I was an alcoholic or not. Can you believe how crazy I am? With everything that I've been through, I still struggled with, am I an alcoholic or not? Bottom line is I kept coming back and I kept coming to meetings. And I ended up with a second addiction. I always said that I would never, ever, ever try harsh drugs because my mother was mentally ill. And I was afraid of losing I wasn't afraid of killing anyone. I wasn't afraid of killing myself, going back out there. I was afraid of losing my mind. That was my big fear. And I ended up this summer trying a very harsh drug and liked it very much. And that's really scary. I never, ever, ever would have thought that I would have picked that up. Never say never. And I will never say never. I won't say never again. So this time around, and I wasn't really, you know, making any more friends in AA, because if I make friends in AA, that means I have to be accountable, and I have to be responsible, and I have to actually walk the walk. So I was coming to meetings, but I wasn't really committed, you know. I went to Beaver again in early December. I needed to be in a place where I felt safe, where I had no access to the drug. And I was honest there. You know, I had 28 days when I got in, and it helped me out a lot. Beaver, I think therapy is great, but it's not the end-all, be-all. I need program. I really need program because I have a daily reprieve contingent on my spiritual condition. It states that in the big book. So today, I have a little over 2 months. I can look myself in the mirror. I have a boyfriend that I'm absolutely in love with, that I'm honest with. My fears and all, my bobos and all. My family is grateful to have their Carolyn back, and I'm grateful to be back in their life. I'm grateful that I can look at my daughter in the eye again. My disease is so powerful that regardless of looking at my gorgeous little 3-year-old, I could still pick up that drink. So I need to do whatever it takes to stay sober. And if it means I need to do 10 meetings a week, then I'll do 10 meetings a week. Because let me tell you, I never stopped at one drink, and I never stopped at one line. And on the days when I'm feeling, I was sharing with a couple of ladies out there before, who were saying sometimes it's so nice, especially in the winter, just to snuggle up in front of the TV and watch a movie instead of go to a meeting. Well, when I feel like doing that, I think about all the times it was 40 below, and I didn't mind driving to the bar, and I didn't mind going to the Depener at 5 minutes to 11 o'clock when I was comfortable. So you know what? If I was willing to do that then I need to do whatever it takes to get my butt to a meeting or to pick up the phone when a sponsee calls or to pick up the phone to see how you're doing for a change. I am obsessed with myself. I am self-obsessed, and I need to work with other people so that I can give my mind a rest and let God do his handiwork. And for that, I'm grateful. And thank you for listening.
Thank you so much, Caroline. And it's funny, I keep calling you Caroline, but it's Carolyn, right? And you haven't skipped a beat.
I think you're just kind of grateful, and your share is you're just...